We'll take Q&A for 10 minutes now. We'll end up starting the next session at 1:45 instead. I'm going to leave it up to the chairs and the folks in those sessions, whether after an hour and a quarter of working together, they feel like they're done and they need a half hour break, or where they want to go 15 minutes into the break. We purposely left a half hour break, as many groups do, so that we could have a little flexibility there. I do want to give you a sense as to what those sessions are going to be, because I hope you're going to target your questions really towards getting us thinking around what we want to do with those working sessions. This has been the candy part. Now we're going to put you to work. So what we really hope you'll do is get to know each other in those sessions. Do introduce yourselves. You bring a wealth of background, but then realize that who's in the sessions. In the sessions are going to be researchers, policymakers, NGO folks, and we really do want you to come up with challenging ideas, provocative ideas, and quite specific ideas. We hope that's going to do two things. One, we will be reporting out of this. We will be reporting out of this to government, to NGO. We'll be collecting your ideas. We will be using them. There'll be note takers there. There'll be taped sessions. We also know that many of the people who can make a difference are sitting right here in this room. They're people who are running NGOs, who are doing research on inequalities, that it's not just research to sit on a shelf, but to push the envelope, who are policymakers, who are running programs, and we'll hope that it's going to give you good ideas. I think we already got a start of what that might mean to be specific, to be concrete, and to get us moving forward when we heard from Doug and he raised those four criteria he's holding up as measurement as to whether a program is successful. Karen mentioned the global fund. We'd love to hear what that fund should spend money on, how it should be structured, what would be really specific suggestions. Clyde talked really compellingly about the importance of early childhood. How do we make that practically happen in Canada? We've really stumbled. How do we make it practically happen globally? So knowing that that's what we're about to do in 10 minutes, I open the floor to questions, comments, hopefully really targeted towards moving us forward on that. And my only request, and yes, you can go first, is please go to the mics. Feel free to pass them around or just stand behind them, but that way they can tape you and everybody can hear you. Thank you.
My name is Stephen Davis. I'm the Executive Director of Academics for Higher Education and Development. I think Karen Moody talked about ownership, country or local ownership. And the question I have is, how do you negotiate the value of equity and equality when the local ownership says that that's not part of the values that we have? We're not in favor of that. That's contrary to our practices and our religion. I want to know what you do.
Go ahead. Well, if I really knew the answer to that, but I have a suspicion of a beginning of an answer to what do we do, and that is that we really need to unlock or look at the areas, the voice issue, the issue of are citizens able to make claims on their government. It brings us into the field of governance and away from the field of education and making sure kids are in school, but in a way it doesn't, because schools themselves, of course, are models of human society. They tell kids everything about how they're going to be expected to act in the broader world. So attention to civics and to citizenship learning and to school organization, ability and opportunity for voice of parents and community in the school, these are all very, very important levers. But again, as I said, if we don't aggregate that voice, if we find out that we have thousands upon thousands of parents' committees and mothers' committees, parents and mothers' committees, interfacing with every school in Mali, but there's no national network that can aggregate the voice of the mothers, then we know we have a big problem. And so we should look not only about our kids' reading, but are the schools and the school systems and the parents around it able to aggregate voice about and make claims? That seems to me to be very important. And I suspect that you will get a greater attention to equality.
I hope we'll, I just want to add, I hope we'll take that as a challenge, not just to Karen, but to all of us, as we go into this session, about where we get the political will for this. Some of this will be how do you get the political will to change early education or to change tertiary, but absolutely the fundamental question around political will around equity is central. Yes.
Thanks. I'm Diane Richler, and I'm the president of Inclusion International, and I have a question for Doug. One of the drivers you mentioned was context, and I'm wondering if you can expand on that a little bit. I'm thinking particularly of some things that you've said in the past about diversity in schools and in classrooms, and wondering how much that's an issue, how diverse learning environments are for outcomes.
Thanks. One of the questions I struggled with right from the beginning of my career was, if you had an average child, average ability, average socioeconomic background, and so on, would the child be better over here in this group of schools that are mostly serving low socioeconomic status or low ability children, or over in this group of schools that are serving high ability and high socioeconomic status students? And the answer to that question is that average child will do better over here virtually every time. There's a composition effect that's very pervasive. So what it means then, as soon as you segregate kids into high and low status groups, either within classrooms or within schools or within whole school systems, among schools within districts or whole school systems, if you segregate them, kids from poor backgrounds do a whole lot worse. Kids from rich backgrounds do a little bit better, but not much better, right? So what it means then is you always got to have your sniffers out for things that are segregating kids. And the trouble is, once you entrench segregation in a system, it's very hard to go back. We had an incredible experience last year when our Minister of Education announced he wanted a program of universal French instruction for everyone. Well, the middle class revolted because they liked their selective French immersion programs, thank you very much. And what it looks like on the ground then is that in a typical Canadian school, I've been using this figure around 30%. If you've got a typical classroom then, if things were equally distributed out of a class of, say, 28, 30 kids, you'd probably have 7 or 8 that were vulnerable. But if you segregate them, all of a sudden now, instead of 7 or 8, you've got 15 or 16. And that's really what it looks like on the ground. So now imagine that slide that I showed you with Brazil. That you've got a real marked segregation amongst rural and urban areas and so on. So you've got a real high concentration of kids that are coming to school without some of the basic skills that a lot of our kids would come to school with. And if you put a lot of them in a classroom all at once, then it's very hard to get any kind of traction. You've just got too many kids who are vulnerable for, you know, a single teacher to deal with. So that's just a fundamental thing. We've tested it for every country that participated in the program of international student assessment. The effects of that come out differently across countries, but it's evident in every country. In countries that have selective systems like Germany, then parents' social and cultural capital, economic capital, plays a bigger role in that selection. Whereas in our system, where it's a little more, well, quite a bit more equal than Germany, social class doesn't matter so much as to what school you go to, but once you're in the school, it makes a whole lot of difference. So, but either way, the social class background, and particularly segregation, has a huge effect on kids' outcomes. If you take the inclusion perspective that you, some of your work would come from, if you think of special ed kids, then it's the same story. If you put a whole lot of them in a single classroom, those kids aren't going to do as well as they would if they're in more mixed heterogeneous groups.
We're going to take this one last question or comment, and then we're going to go off into groups.
Okay, Jessica Please. Ballin from the University of Victoria. Thank you so much. These were three incredibly stimulating and nuanced presentations. It's got all kinds of things swimming around in my own mind about the questions that you've raised. But one of the things that, you know, when I hear, Clyde, you said that in order to raise and level the bar, we have to have de facto universal access to the experiences and opportunities that make children ready to learn. But I think the challenge for us is very much that we don't know what those experiences and opportunities are. I think we need a lot more basic research on, on what experiences and opportunities enable children to learn in different kinds of cultural and language context. And, you know, I think that we can't answer those questions through basic research here in what I think, Karen, you're calling the North, not what my circumpolar colleagues would call the North, but I don't think we can do that here. And I think we do need, as you've said so clearly, Karen, we need local community-level voices. So I loved your image of all these parent mother advisory groups in Mali. I mean, that although there may not be a national forum for those mothers to be able to advocate and put pressure on their government, the idea that they would even exist would be a really important first step. And are beginning to understand what equal access and effective experiences are in that local context. Related to that, another issue that came up for me in listening to you speak is, you know, Doug, when I'm not sure who's responsible for the saying that the first thing, the transition is the important transition is learning to read and then reading to learn. But, you know, in my perspective in early education, the very first critical transition is learning to speak and learning language and be able to be fluent in the language of your culture. And I think, you know, and I think we also need to be paying attention to what people want and need in the local context in terms of the medium, of the language medium of instruction. And I think, so I think we have to be very careful about thinking we know what are the universal indicators of effective education when we're thinking about equity globally.
I'm going to give Clyde a minute to respond to us, mainly on early education, just because of time, so that we can move on.
No, I think, Jessica, those are very, very good points. The key thing I think I would say is that at a kind of a generic level, we understand what the best kind of nurturant environments are. You know, people like, for instance, the people who did the Abecedarian studies have done a very good job of abstracting out generic lessons. But I agree with you. The question of how do those generic lessons apply to the Aboriginal community in northeastern BC, to the ghetto community on the outskirts of Nairobi, et cetera, really involves a lot of local knowledge and application. And then the systems whereby you get intercommunal learning need to be built up one way or another. And it's interesting, when Doug was talking before about the bizarre nature of education, training of teachers, you know, it is also interesting that when we think about what is the global intelligence system for learning what people are learning works, there isn't a very good one. You know, there are glossy magazines that sometimes show happy-faced people sitting around, you know, in the sub-Saharan region doing X, Y, and Z, and you see these things and all. There's little bits of that going on, but, you know, whether or not there, I mean, really there isn't at this point, I don't think, a really good way that communities that are have distinct characteristics can communicate with other communities that may have similar distinct characteristics, what it is they're learning that work. And I think, you know, that might be something that we should be thinking about in terms of our development assistance, whether or not we can promote intercommunality that way, some way or another.
Thank you very much. Join me in thanking the panel, please. And it's easy to remember where we're all heading. Those who are doing preschool, early years, and the primary school are on the first floor. Those who are doing secondary are on the second floor. So secondary and tertiary, there's room on the second floor. We're going to go straight to those sessions now, be in those sessions till 3 or 3:15, and then do come down for a break. Then we'll go the second sessions before we rejoin.